the cross with no angelic defenders, no bolts of fire from the sky smiting his enemies. Villiers had actually laughed when the missionary told him the story of the crucifixion. What had the mighty God done to avenge his son? Torn the curtain on the temple. Cross-hemming, and you'd suffer more than a ripped wall hanging for your pains. So, the prince was in the north, and Harik was in the north, and even this girl who seemed so important was there. He suspected magical beliefs figured in her disappearance, and a look around the whale people's holy sites might uncover her. The prince wouldn't be far behind. Villiers thought he'd give it a go. It was better than returning empty-handed to Hemming, and maybe there really was gold up there, though he doubted it. The journey was excruciatingly slow, hampered by argument and indecision. The whole trip should have taken them a couple of weeks, even against the current. Instead, it consumed months. The berserk wanted to go after Vali, but didn't seem to realize that they first had to find out where he had been. There was no point randomly hurtling around the coast, as Bjarki seemed to want to do. They needed to ask if there had been a shipwreck, if strangers had passed by, if anyone had taken captives. The whale people were simple and friendly folk. They started out hostile and threatening, waving spears and screaming, but if you gave them a coin or two, they thought you a very fine fellow indeed, and no threat. Otherwise, why would you have given them the coins? So they wanted to please. Yes, there had been a shipwreck. Yes, strangers had gone past. Yes, there were captives. In their little dwellings on the headlands, behind beaches, in their tents, and by their fires, Velis listened to them tell their stories of great storms, men with burning eyes, and princesses of southern kingdoms tied to reindeer sleds and taken north to marry water spirits. The most recent of the stories, he guessed, was around 50 years old. He had been freezing on and off the boat for 2 months when they came to where there was no further land to the north and the coast turned east.
"What now?" said the berserk.
It was cold, very cold.
"We go on," said Villiers.
"To what end?" said the berserk. "The prince is wrecked on the coast. We should turn round and look for him."
"Tell me, Bjarki," said Villiers, "is this near where you were wrecked with Harik's son?"
"Half a day's sail south," he said. "We never did get to the sorcerer's gold."
"No. Perhaps we should just take a peek down the coast and see what we can see."
Bjarki shook his head.
"They enchanted me. I became weak."
"You'll suffer fewer enchantments if you don't drink their wine."
"It wasn't wine."
"I dread to think what it was," said Villiers.
He knew very well. Fermented milk, a drink he always found deeply unpleasant, and one he'd had enough of in his travels.
"It was enchantment," said Bodvar. "Not the wine. Drums! They made me weak."
Villiers raised his eyebrows.
"Well, I've been weak all my life, so I have no strength for these sorcerers to rob. Come on, just a peek. I think I can only guarantee a rock in the sea, but who knows? You might get enough to pay Forkbeard his compensation. You did vow to pay him, didn't you? You should do something to show your mettle. You do have something of a history of failure."
Villiers was treading a fine line between goading the berserk to action and enraging him. The berserk looked at him.
"I saved you," he said.
"And now I will save you. The prince, if he is alive, will be on the Holy Island. If not, then their holy men will have heard of him. And these are peaceful people. They lie down at the first threat. If there is no treasure, then there will at least be fine furs to be taken."
"They are sorcerers."
There was no point in appealing to reason any more. The best way was to agree that the whale people were powerful sorcerers, in which case they were doing rather badly, and that their spells needed to be taken seriously.
"I have thought of that," said Villiers. "I have brought this mask with me. They use it in the ceremonies, and it deflects their power away from you.
Then the mask is mine, said Bodvar Bjarki.
As you wish, said Veles. But if we are enchanted, I shall rely on you to come to my rescue.
Bjarki nodded and took the wolf mask from Veles. He put it to his face. It was tiny against his massive skull, and the ties at its back hardly reached around his head.
This will protect me.
All of you, the crew included.
Good. If you're lying, Libor, then I'll cut off your head.
Veles thought that if he was lying and the sorcery was real, Bjarki might not be in a position to cut off anyone's head. If the sorcery wasn't real, well, he was sure the mask offered good protection against people clicking their fingers and banging their drums at you.
The berserk didn't really think things through, thought the merchant.
The boat travelled east down the north coast into the falling cold. The sea didn't freeze, but they began to see smears of white on the landscape. The little ballast fire did something to keep him warm, but Veles couldn't quite stop shivering. It was a sort of crafty chill that you could banish momentarily by the fire or by adding another fur, but that always seemed to work a freezing finger in, a cold of the bones dropping from iron skies. 2 weeks passed the turn east. They came to what he thought he was looking for, but when they stopped, the local whale people told him that the island he was seeking, Dormin, also known as Vagoy, the Wolf Island, the Blood Red Rock, was further east still. He gave them a little money, and said he would prefer that island to be beneath his feet as he spoke, but only a couple then said that it was. The whale people weren't liars, he knew, just very eager to please.
"Is there treasure there?"
asked Bjarki, but Veles did not translate this. Instead, he said,
"Do your people hold it very holy?"
"It is the place where our ancestors are. It is the mouth of the other worlds."
"And offerings are left there?"
"More riches than you can imagine."
"That's quite a lot," said Veles in his own tongue.
"What did he say?" said Bjarki.
"I don't think we're going to be disappointed," said Veles.
They went on, and a week later, under a sickle moon, spotted the island. The dusk was flat and cold, and the island rose from the sea in a featureless hump with a thin snow covering.
"This?"
Bjarki was at his side.
"Fits, doesn't it? The blood red rock?"
"Looks more black to me,"
said Bjarki.
"Use your imagination. No, on second thoughts, don't bother," said Veles. "Just find a landing spot, will you?"
"Will the prince be here?"
"I think we've established that I don't know," said Veles. "Something may be here that may lead us to him. If not, there may be something else for us. And if not that, then the next time I hear treasure in Ultima Thule, I'll be able to tell whoever it is they're talking rubbish. Or perhaps I won't. Perhaps I'll send them up here to freeze their backside to the boards as I've done."
The ship reached a small beach, grounding easily in the calm sea. Veles noted that anyone on the island wouldn't get off without help. There were a number of little boats across the narrow strait drawn up on a mainland beach, but none on the island itself. Veles disembarked, as did the berserk and his men. Bjarki had his sword drawn. Veles glanced at it. In his experience, a sword was more of a liability than a help in some situations. What was the berserk going to do if 200 baying whale men appeared to defend their holy island from invaders? Wasn't it better not to appear threatening, particularly and especially if you actually were offering a threat? They made their way up a rusty slope of loose stones. Veles thought the whale people had chosen a very unpromising location for their gateway to the gods. He had been in many such places, and some of them were very pleasant. Gardens in the sunshine, vineyards even. Veles shivered.
He wanted to get out of this place, but not until he had found what he had come for.
"Aha!" said the berserk. "Maybe you are right, Velus."
He was holding up a fine reindeer coat.
"This'll fetch a decent bit when we've given it a scrub."
Velus looked at the coat. It was well made and relatively new. It would fetch a reasonable price, he thought, though he was more inclined to put it on against the cold. He stroked the fur, and something came off on his hand. Blood.
"That, as my mother used to say," said Velus, "is the mule of stains, and very difficult to get out. It's dried on, too. It won't fetch much."
They went on, and found other things. There were drums and shoes, clothes and packs. Everywhere there was blood. Then they came upon their first body, and another. All were awfully mutilated.
"It's a corpse horde," said Bjarki. "A trove of slaughter."
Velus might have argued with his choice of words, but not with the sentiment. The top of the island was a field of the dead.
"Lord Odin has had some fun here," said Bjarki.
He had the wolf mask over his face. He looked slightly ridiculous, as it only stretched to just below his mouth.
"Indeed, indeed," said Velus.
He looked around and was glad he had given the mask to the berserk. Whatever had done the killing seemed to favour men who masqueraded as animals. There were about 30 corpses, or what the birds had left of them. A wolf's nose jutted out here, a gigantic beak there. The ears of a huge arctic hare lay at his feet. Velus could read what had happened. The coats and drums had been dropped by people who had not wanted to risk anything hampering their escape. He kicked over a mask with his foot. There was a head inside it.
"Looks like somebody beat us to it," said Bjarki. "Though they've left enough furs. Doubtless their ship was too laden with gold."
He was more used to this sort of sight than Velus, and he picked his way through the corpses while the merchant caught his breath and composed himself. Velus looked about him. He wanted to be certain that whoever or whatever had caused this mess had gone from the island. The bodies had not been there for very long, and the ravens still had some rich pickings. One pecked at a corpse next to him, watching Velus as the corpse itself seemed to watch him through the eyes of a stag mask. He didn't like this at all, and shooed the bird away. His confidence in the non-existence of supernatural powers was always stronger by a fire, drinking with his fellows, than it was in such wild places. The crew spread over the island, looking to loot the unlootable. There was the odd fur, the odd knife, but these people had been very poor. Their drums might be worth a bit, Velus thought. He could always sell them back to them, or offer them as curiosities to the courts of the south.
"Here's your treasure!"
It was Bjarki's voice, shouting from somewhere down the slope towards the open sea. Velus couldn't see where he was calling from. He walked down. This slaughter must have been some sort of mass human sacrifice, he thought.
"Some blurt, eh?"
said Bjarki, as if reading his mind.
"Old King Hrutr did 9 slaves at midsummer one year, but this beats that, head or rump, however you look at it."
He pointed into a cave.
"Down there,"
he said.
"Look!"
Velus squinted into the darkness. He could see nothing. Anxiety gripped him. He wondered if Bjarki was luring him into the dark of the cave to kill him. No. The berserk would have had no qualms at all about splitting his skull in broad daylight in front of a market-day crowd if the mood took him. If Bjarki had wanted him dead, he would be so already.
"Do you have any way of seeing better?"
Bodvar Bjarki picked up a dead brand from the fingers of a corpse with as little disquiet as if the man had still been alive and simply passed it to him. Velus struck a flint, kindled the sparks on some wood shavings he had in his pouch, and applied them. The torch flamed, and the men went down. Shadows danced around them as they descended. The light of the torch seemed merely an absence of dark, not a thing of itself. In it, they saw runes painted on the walls.
"Can you read them?" said Bodvar Bjarki.
"Treasure," said Veles, "and good fortune."
He had never bothered too much with runes, preferring the Latin alphabet. He could read them, but with difficulty. He wished they did say that, but it seemed to be the normal bilge about spirits and gods.
"How did you see in here?" said Veles.
It seemed very dark to him.
"It's obvious it's a tomb," said Bjarki.
"So you haven't actually been in here?"
"I have no intention of letting you out of my sight, merchant. I don't trust you. You'd strike a bargain with the man, maroon me here, sell the boat, and cheat them out of the profit if I gave you as much as half a chance."
"The idea never occurred to me," said Phyllis.
It hadn't, actually, but it was good to know Bjarki feared a mutiny, and kind of him to suggest a way it might be done. The passageway stopped at a large mound of stones. There was no sign of collapse on the tunnel roof, so Veles took them to have been placed there. On one large block, a rune had been carved, a jagged sideways swipe with a line through it.
"What does that mean?"
"I've never seen it before," said Veles.
Some other men were behind him now, peering through the wavering light.
"It's a holy sign of their people," said one. "Very likely," said Veles. "And whoever did this slaughter has taken care to secrete something here."
"What?"
Veles shrugged and smiled.
"We won't find out until we open it, will we? I suggest you get to work."
Bjarki grunted. Then he began on the pile of stones. Chapter 46. From the Dark. Saitada sat in a shaft of light that cut through from a finger-width opening in the side of the upper cave. She watched her image looking back from the blade of the sword. He was much older. How much, she didn't know. The unburned side of her face was not pretty anymore. Her skin was tight on her bones, pale from lack of light, dirty and cut. Saitada had been a long time in the dark. The witch caves were endless and deep. She had not known at first that her boys had been taken and had remained underground, trawling the blackness with her fingertips, reaching for a hand, the brush of some hair, listening for the cries of her children in the dark, living off the water of streams and food she could beg from the witch's servants. For years, Saitada hadn't known why her children had been taken, but crawling through blind chimneys, emerging from dripping sumps of rock where her mouth had stolen the inch of air between the water and the tunnel's ceiling, taking candles from the boy servants and watching the light struggle against the deep dark, she listened, and she learned. The witches, who from their lowest caves could hear a hare's breath on the mountainside, to whom the rock and the ice of the troll wall were just a veil through which they saw from sea to sea, did not notice her. And she did not know to think that odd. The older witches, of course, did not speak, and the boys knew only that they needed to fear and to serve them. Neither yielded any information about what had happened to Saitada's children. The girls, however, initiates new to the dark, shivered and trembled and clung to what they had been. Saitada came to them, sat with them, hugged them and calmed them, though she never thought to say anything. The girls needed to talk, to confess their fears, as they would have to their mothers. They told her, among other things, of the threat that was coming, of the deaths and the terror of death. They told her, too, about two boys who would become one wolf to kill the murderous god. One boy's body would host the spirit of the wolf, the other would be his food, giving his brother the strength he needed. The witch queen had taken the boys, and only one would live. Saitada never found it strange that she could understand the girl's language. She only knew that her babies had gone. They were always in her mind, their memory like a tumour that ate everything else she had seen, everything she had been. After years alone, she was not a person, just a love and a hate encased in flesh, cherishing the thought of her children, loathing the witch queen who had taken them, watching death begin to creep through the caves. The girls had all died when Saitada's grief was at its height. She had gone to the deep dark, where she had thought she would die, when five of them were dead, and emerged to find none alive. The boys were all dead, too. From one she had taken tinder and lit a candle. She had no idea why she had come back. Her own motivations were now a mystery to her. But in a week her purpose became clear. She had come back to watch the witch queen kill her sisters. Some went in their sleep. Some were strangled, and some burned. The majority would have died from neglect, with no boys to tend them. But Saitada brought them food from the sacrifices. It wasn't kindness. She saw the distress the murders caused the witch queen, and didn't want starvation or thirst to spare her a single one. Saitada saw how the deaths drove the queen on to madness, and she sought to guide her hand, leaving rope or tinder, stakes or, once, a long pin that she found in some cloth left as a sacrifice. The queen quickly put Saitada's gifts to use. Saitada watched for the arrival of the god the girls had talked about, but saw nothing. Rock, pool, and stream remained the same in the yellow light of a candle stub. The torpid air and dripping damp didn't change when the flame was spent. When the witches were all dead, she tried to kill the witch queen herself. She could not go through with it. Twice she pulled the queen from the pools of the dead by a rope at her neck. Once she took a little knife, pressed it to her breast, but then drew back. Were the runes protecting the witch queen? Even Saitada could sense them now, chiming and splashing and fizzing in the blackness as the witch endured her daily sufferings by water and cold. Frustration began to overwhelm Saitada, and she spent a long time trying to think how she could strike her enemy down. But every time she moved against her, she faltered. She found his sword in the lowest caves. It thumped against her knee as she stumbled on the uneven floor. She knew what it was the instant she held it. The slim curve in the jeweled scabbard, the keenness of the blade when it was drawn. He could kill the witch. He could kill anyone. Saitada knew only one thing about him, his name. Orthon. It was enough. She took the sword and went up towards the light. Chapter 47. Descent. Feleg could not sail, so they were forced to travel by land. The landscape now looked entirely different to when he had come north, a wide field of white leading to distant mountains. But he knew well where they should go. A wolf can always find its home. And he headed south under the swirling skies with Adisla behind him. With her wound she could not walk far, but Feleg sat her on one of the reindeer sleighs and led the animal. The Noaidi who had owned it had not appeared to claim it. The wolfman loaded the sled with good reindeer coats, a tent, furs, snowshoes and boots, and took some flints and plenty of tinder. He also took a spear. He didn't need it to fight, but wanted a sign to warn anyone they encountered to look elsewhere if robbery was on their mind. The Noaides, who had survived, were in no mood to argue. By the time Felig finished piling the stones, all but one sorcerer had gone. The man had marked a stone with a rune, put it on the heap, and left. To Felig, the rune was vaguely familiar. He wished he had asked what it meant, but he had no language in common with the holy man. Was it a seal to magically hold the beast in place? Or was it something else? A warning, maybe? He thought on it as they headed south for the troll wall. As he made up the tent and a fire within it, and brought Adisla the things he had caught and killed for her. The wolf is the king of winter, and Felig was almost happy, bringing in his kills and allowing Adisla to cook them, rather than eat the meat raw, as had been his habit. It was the life he had glimpsed as he had kissed her by the post where she had cut him free. Adisla, however, was withdrawn. Her tears had been replaced by silence. Vali's condition, she was sure, was her fault. There was no logic to her thinking, but she couldn't shake her conviction that her liaison with someone so far above her social standing, what she had done to her mother, even her capitulation in agreeing to marry Drengi, were all to blame for what had happened to him. She had grown up with a powerful belief in magic, been raised to learn healing, and even some divination. Things were linked, she felt. Her mother had said people stand at the edge of an ocean of events that touches unseen islands and shores. She had allowed something bad to grow between her and Vali. Now something far more terrible had grown within him. But as they rested by their fires, and Felig described the amazing events of his childhood, the hopelessness she felt about her relationship with Vali bore the seed of hope for a future with Felig. Slowly she found she could talk to him. She spoke about her youth with Vali, and then just about herself and her life with her brothers, and most of all her mother. The wolfman listened without comment, and when she told him what she had done to Disa, he just sat for a while before saying, "I wish I had known such love."
"To kill her?"
"To save her," he said. "She was fated to die, and she knew it. Better quickly at her daughter's hand than after the torments of the Danes. She chose the instrument of her death. You, who she loved. You are no more to blame than if she had used the knife herself.
I wish I could believe it."
"Do you think your mother would have wanted this grief for you?"
"No."
"What would she have wanted?" Adisla looked up into the shining walls of the night sky.
"For me to get on with my life, to meet a good man and bear fine sons," she said.
Felix smiled.
"Then make that your aim," he said.
Felix, she could see, was not a wolf. The shaman had not taken his humanity with his chants and brews. Felig was a man, plain and simple, someone who'd been raised to savagery, but who had reclaimed himself from it. He would make a good husband, she was sure, and she would have been proud to be his wife, had the fates put them together before. The days were short as they travelled through the mountain passes, but when the moon was bright, Felig pressed on.
"Do you know where you're going?"
she asked him.
"The south," he said. "The mountains there are like a fold from this sea to the troll wall. We will follow the coast as best we can, and then use them to steer us to where we want to go."
Adisla was left breathless by the beauty of the northern winter, of the bleak hills and the blinding plains, though she found the country barren and threatening compared to the softer features of her coastal home. The journey was rough and bumpy, though the sled was warm beneath the furs, and she even managed to doze. They had been travelling for weeks, and the snow was thick, when the land in the distance seemed to buckle into ridges of black. As they got nearer, they saw them, the troll peaks, rising up in crests like the gigantic waves of a solid sea. They appeared daunting, though the way to them was easy, the ground frozen solid, rivers turned into roads. Occasionally they came upon a family hut. There were signs of life, or rather lives that had been. No one came to greet them. No dog barked, no child called out. Clothes left in the sun to dry had bleached and rotted before they froze. Adisla looked at Felek and shrugged as if to say, "What happened here?" He shrugged back. "These hills leak nightmares," he said. "They always have. Perhaps it all got too much." As they moved through the country at the back of the troll wall, it seemed the leak had become a flood. Everything was abandoned, everything in ruins. Not a house was inhabited. They followed the hills inland, skirting them before climbing up through a narrow valley. In the heavy light of evening, wolves howled invisibly from the ridges. Adisla, who could walk well by now, looked at Feleg in alarm, but the wolfman was calm.
"They are my brothers," he said,
"and they are welcoming me home." He returned their call, and Adisla saw them. What she had taken for rocks were animals, now moving down the slope. Felix smiled and cut the fretting reindeer free of the sled. "The animal has served us well," said Adisla.
"They would have him, tied to the sled or free," said Felix. "This way, he dies free. It is what he was meant to do."
There was no way out for the reindeer, wolves ahead and behind. It turned one way and then the other, a pattering run forward, a pattering run back. And then it stopped. In a moment, the pack was on it.
"It didn't even try to run," said Adisla.
"It knew there was no point. Why die exhausted? It's bad enough to die without being made to work for it."
"What are we doing?" said Adisla.
"Working for it," said Felix.
"You sound like Bragi."
"Thank you."
He hadn't told her the old man was dead. She had enough to contend with. The wolves fed, and when they had finished, Felix shouldered the tent, and they walked on up the pass. The pack followed behind. The mountain in front of them had seemed big from a distance. Close up, it was immense, bigger than anything Adisla had ever imagined, an enormous barren sweep of grey and white rising out of the valley floor and disappearing into cloud at the top.
"If I saw the world tree," said Adisla, holding Felix's hand and looking up at it, "this is how I think it would look."
"We are going into it," said Felix.
"How?"
"We need to find a wolf trap," said Felix.
Adisla thought of Vali, transformed and starving in that horrible cave. She let go of Felix's hand and said no more. Felix led the way up the mountain, and Adisla's wound began to pain her. Felix saw her limping.
"I can go on my own. It might be better like that."
"I'll stay with you," said Adisla. "I am linked to you now. I'll die in this wilderness without you."
Felix longed to hold her, to tell her how he felt about her. But he saw the resolution with which she drove herself on, her dedication to the prince, and he concentrated on picking a safe route for the climb. The lower reaches were easy enough, snowy but not deadly cold as long as you kept moving or had fire. There was even a track winding across the mountain. Adisla had always imagined mountains as unrelenting climbs, but this one had frequent breaks in the slope. They scrambled up scree or through fields of boulders, then along ridges where they seemed to go sideways rather than up. As they ascended, the path cut across slopes so steep that Adisla had to dig the butt end of the spear into the snowfield to prevent herself sliding off the mountain. The light was bleak and drained of colour. Felix stopped where the path gave out on a broad area of barren scree, a shoulder in a ridge that went up into ice. In the snowless lee of a big rock, there were several pots on the ground, along with two or three bottles. Felix picked up a pot and sniffed it.
"Butter," he said, "but licked clean by my brothers."
He took up a bottle and removed the wooden bung.
"Mead," he said. "This is as far as normal men can go without being certain of madness. It's where offerings are left, but no one has collected them. Look!"
He pointed to the side of the track behind them. Adisla saw a dark area.
"That was a wolf pit, to protect the offerings," said Felix. "Men fear the witches, wolves do not. I snapped its spikes."
"How do they ever get anything before the wolves?"
"They have servants, and they take it quickly," said Felix.
Silently, a wolf had come to his shoulder. It nosed the ground before glancing at Felix and going on. The animal had almost looked as if it was asking for instructions. They went on, up, up, and then down to a valley, up again and down into another valley. Here the land was barren and rocky. A river plunged almost as a waterfall off one side of the hill, tumbling into a wide pool before leading away down the mountain. The wolf with Felix streaked across towards the pool. Just in front of it he stopped and picked something up in his mouth. Adisla and Felix followed. The wolf had a human hand, a child's, in its mouth. Felix breathed in.
"It is near here," he said. "Very near."
They searched for 2 days, but found nothing. There was little dry wood for the fire, food was running low, and Felix didn't have time to catch anything. He was scouring the mountain, directing the wolves back and forth like a shepherd with his dogs. Adisla sat in the tent and tried to keep warm, resting her aching leg. Felix returned to the pool.
"Nothing," he said. "The wolves can tell children go all over this mountain, but the tracks go over and over each other. They drink here, and then go up there, then they come back. Or so it seems."
Adisla looked at the water. It was very clear and strangely not frozen. They were a good height above the valley floor, and even down there the river was solid, and any pools were frozen a hard blue. This was still liquid.
"There is no ice here," said Adisla.
Felix looked at the water. That hadn't occurred to him. He dipped his hand in. It wasn't warm, but it was nowhere near as cold as it should have been. It was clear, too, very clear.
"Enchantment," he said.
"Perhaps." "Is this an entrance, do you think?" he said.
"Maybe one of them. There are supposed to be many, but neither I nor the wolves can find them."
"Will you go in?"
"Yes."
First he built a fire inside the Noaidi tent. Then he spent a few moments puffing and blowing beside the water, rubbing his hands and stamping his feet. Adisla wondered what he was doing, and thought he looked far from confident. He went in up to his waist.
"It is not cold," he said. "Not at all."
He went in deeper, made a few back-and-forth movements, tried to dive, but immediately came back to the surface, choking and coughing. Then he tried again, but with the same result.
"Are you all right?" said Adisla.
"Yes."
He was shaking. He steeled himself and put his face into the water. Then he did dive and didn't appear for a couple of heartbeats. He came back up in a flurry of flapping arms and kicking legs, beating at the water with his hands and gulping down mouthfuls. Gasping, he managed to find his feet and stagger to the fire, where she cradled his shivering body in her arms, as the Noaidi had done for her when she had gone over the side of the ship. He regained his breath.
"There is something down there, a lip on the bottom. It is possible to go underneath. I will try again."
"Wait a moment, you need to rest,"
she said. She had never seen him look like this. For the first time since she had known him, the wolf man had fear in his eyes.
"What is it?" she said.
"There must be other ways in."
"Is this a way in?"
"There is a rope, and it is secured to something. I think it's a guide. But there will be other ways in. The boys can't take everything in this way. It will all be soaked."
"This is the way in we have. Why search for another?"
Feilig looked at the ground.
"I don't like the water," he said.
"Oh, Feilig," said Adisla.
She squeezed him to her. He looked into her eyes, and on impulse, she rested her lips on his in a light kiss. Feilig didn't know what to say, still less what to do. Adisla slipped from his arms, took three big gulps of breath, and dived into the pool. Chapter 48 The Pool of Tears. At first, Sitada had gone north by mistake, through deserted farmsteads, past houses where now only rats sheltered from the cold. She had picked up some things of use to her there, two mouldy blankets which provided some warmth, enough rags to cover her face, bind her feet and wrap the sword, and a cup in which to melt snow for water. It had been 3 days before she had seen smoke from a hut, and when she had spoken the name Orthon and gestured to ask if he was there, the people had laughed and pointed to the south past the troll wall. They thought she was a simpleton, but still poured their advice into her ears. It was not safe to travel to the south. The land around those mountains was cursed. Nightmares of death and torture had come down from the slopes, and now no one could stand to live there. The witches, it was said, were dying, and their magic had poisoned the land. Sitada listened, and said nothing more. She could understand them, though she didn't know how. That night, the son of the house decided to have a look at what the old beggar had in her bundle, but as he went to prize it from Saitada's fingers, he caught a glimpse of that burn on the side of her face and went back to his bed. In the morning, ashamed by his actions the night before, he gave her a warm cloak, some old boots, and a rough tunic that the dog had been using for a bed. Saitada bowed to thank them for their hospitality and turned for the long journey south. Orthon's people had not forgotten him, and at the farms and among the flocks, they told her where she needed to go. The snow was lighter in the south, though the wind was cruel. Still, the people kept to the tradition of welcome for travellers that existed throughout that land, took her in by night, and pointed her on her way the next morning. She found him, 2 days' walk into the iron woods. A hunter took her half the way in out of pity for her face and showed her the direction she needed to take, to keep among the birches and come down if the woods turned to only firs, to keep the slope to her left, the pole star to her right, and to trust to luck for the rest. After so long in the dark, the night made her dizzy and her head felt open to the sky. And what a sky! It was shot with fire, swirls of green and red, that seemed to her as if the gods had lit their beacons to rejoice in what she was doing. She didn't stop to stare. Her purpose and her need for warmth drove her on. It was the following evening, and the moon was full when she met him. He was sitting on a rock, looking into a pool. Much of it was frozen, but where the pool was fed by a small waterfall, the water was still free. His long silver hair shone in the moonlight like water itself, or like a prophecy of how the waterfall would look when the cold finally took it. He did not look at her, but remained focused on the pool. Without turning his head, he said,
"Do not look to me for battle, stranger. There are enough widows screaming in my dreams."
Sitada did not reply. The king had no fire and no cloak, and was so still that the plumes of steam that came from his freezing breath made her think of a mountain wreathed in mist. Eventually he looked up. No spearman or berserk could have made him stand, but Cytada did.
"Lady, I have thought of you," he said.
She bowed her head. The king went on.
"That thought drew me here."
He pointed to the pool.
"He is in here, the man you saw me send to the ocean floor, and the other kinsmen I threw away. It seems to me that this is a magic pool, fed not by the hills, but by the tears of the widows and orphans I have made."
He turned to look at the waterfall, and then back to her. No enemy could have put him in such a state of agitation.
"I am sorry," he said. "I'm sorry for what I did to you. Your face haunts my dreams. I took your children and left you to monsters. And for what? To influence fate, when we know all fates are set at birth. The child will not bring everlasting fame to the Horda, or if he will, in no way that I can see. And if he does, what of it?"
Still, Cytada said nothing. She did not hate the king. He had done no more than move her from one place to another, she thought, as she had been moved from the smith to the farmer to the priests. It was her fate in life to be a slave. He had not, as the witch had done, parted her from her children. Orthon did not see it that way, and felt the shame build further in him. Already that shame had taken him from his kingdom, from his family and his battles, to sit in the freezing woods, listening to the voice of the waters for year upon year, and going to war on the person he had been. And yet, when robbers came, when bears struck at him or the winter bit, he could not let himself go, could not die, and fought always for life. He hunted when he would rather have starved, drank when he would have died of thirst. Cytada had been wrong. Orthon couldn't kill anyone at all. He couldn't kill himself. He couldn't step over the threshold he had pushed so many others across. The dishonor of that hovered above him like a mighty fist that could smash him at any instant.
"What would you have me do, lady?"
Cytada pointed to the north.
"You want me to go with you? For what? You gave me pity and despair. What other gifts do you have for me?"
Cytada stared into his eyes, and said the first word she had ever spoken in his language other than his name, the word she had heard whispered through the witch caves, on the trembling lips of the boys, on the hushed breath of the girls.
"Death," she said.
She walked forward and put the bundle she was carrying into his arms. He opened it, and in the pale light of the woodland night saw the scabbard of the moon sword. He drew the sword and watched the cold spark of the moon run the length of the blade.
"Then I will follow you," he said.
Cytada turned and began to walk out of the forest.
Chapter 49. Manifestation. The witch's energies had been directed towards Liai Bolmai, towards giving him enough power to bring calamity on himself. She had provided the noose. He had put his head inside it and jumped. When he died under the teeth of the wolf, her mind became free. She had been in the wolf's mouth, the lowest cave, lying naked upon the teeth of stone, to demand the gods recognize her suffering with revelation. She wanted to open that door that led even further into the earth, to the bound god, his serpents, and his bowl. But she couldn't find him. The passageways he had inhabited were still there, but there was no sign of Loki, nor even a resonance of his presence. In her pain, frustration, and madness, she did not even notice that the sword she had enchanted was gone. Liai Bolmai's passing had come to her like a lightening in the atmosphere, the feeling of a house with its doors left open to spring after a long, heavy winter. She struggled up from the jagged rocks and stood in her blood and her filth. Although the queen knew her way through the tunnels by touch, she had prepared a little lamp for the end of her ordeal, knowing that she would want the comfort of light after travelling to such dark places. She lit it, and felt a tingle of relief course through her. At her feet was the little piece of leather with the Wolfsangel rune carved on it. She touched it, and felt the resonance of the symbol inside her. It had returned to her. Yes, Odin was dead, taken by the only thing that could take him, the Fenris wolf, come to earth. She had given the hanged god his runes, let him come to his knowledge of himself, and he had cast the spell that had killed him. She stumbled up a passage to where a spring spilled from the ground. She cupped her hand to drink, and as she lifted the water, some passed through her fingers. It fell, she thought, too quickly. She picked up a pebble and rolled it in her hand. It dropped from her fingers and bounced on the rocky floor. Too far, it seemed so to her. Only Odin could frighten the rocks and the streams. Only Odin could make the air depart and the seas pull away. He was still alive. Despite her best efforts, he was still alive. The witch queen, though she was now queen only of herself, her subjects all lying slaughtered, sank down in the dark, trembling. The air was moving in the passageways. She knew what it was, the breath of the god. He was coming for her, and she was alone. No sisters to augment her power, no army of witches to send against him to weaken him. Had she been tricked? Had some deeper magic than hers turned her hands to murder? The witch felt her mind twist. The god crowded in on her, inhabited everything around her, seeped through the passageways and caves to surround and suffocate her. Odin had come for her. Odin, Lord of the Hanged, Odin the Berserk, Odin the Frenzied, Dangler, Screamer, Spear Inviter, Old One-Eye, Odin the Mad, Odin the Poet, Odin the Rain, Odin the Rock, Odin the Dark, and Odin the Light. He waited at every turn of the tunnel, hid in every pool, but flickered away as she snatched her hand into the blackness to catch him, splashed footsteps through the dark as she chased to confront him. And if Odin was there, where was the wolf? She had thought the northern sorcerer would bring Fenris Ulfr to flesh on earth and destroy himself. But if the drum magician was not Odin, then the wolf could not have manifested. She was sure the wolf would only be present when the god came into his knowledge of himself. Sanity came to her now only in glimpses. She had killed, she had suffered, she had striven towards magical insight. Now worms seemed to gnaw through the labyrinth of her thoughts. Structures and links were missing from her mind, ways blocked, burned and broken. So other paths had been found, bored through the lattice of ordinary assumptions, building precarious bridges between areas of her mind that had only ever communicated indirectly. Others would have called it madness, but to the queen it was a blessing which she had won through her years of murder and pain. A realization sparked inside her. She was the first of magicians, a sorcerer without parallel. She had hidden her intentions even from herself, afraid that knowing her own plans would compromise her with the god. If he knew she was acting against him, he would strike. But, deceived, she was safe. While her energies were directed at a false target, the god would think he had time. He might dally, hesitate. And in so doing, he had given her the chance to bring the wolf to the cusp of existence in the best possible way. by getting someone else to do it for her. Her visions told her she had even hidden from herself the true nature of the spell, and which boy would be used to house the spirit of the god come to earth. Odin had not been able to force this secret from her, because she had not known it herself. So the god had not seen the peril he was in until her protector was ready. She recalled the knot at the throat of the first dead girl, the dead lord's necklace with its three tight twists, and she knew it had been a message. One thing hidden inside another, inside yet another. It was magic of the deepest depth, magic that works independently of the sorcerer. Of her and through her, yes, but it could not really be said to be her doing. This was not spell-casting. It was a force she had welcomed in as a child. Something that now cast her. The witch's thoughts floated free of reason and into the realm of magical thinking, beyond logic and sanity, but with the strongest possible connection to reality, the connection of death. She clasped the rune to her, the one she had etched on the piece of leather. She held it to her lips, touched it with her tongue, and breathed in its aroma. The smell was something beyond animal skin. It tasted of tears, funeral pyres, and of the staleness of waiting. Loss. The wolf was coming, but needed something to take the final step, a suffering to propel it into flesh and chase the human out. There was something living in the upper caves, the warmth of the air on the witch's skin told her. It wasn't a rat, and it wasn't a bird. She looked at the rune on the leather, its meaning spilling into her mind. Storm. Werewolf. Wolf trap. The girl, she knew, had come, and now the queen sensed her importance. She was the trap to draw the brothers in. The pieces of the magical puzzle were falling into place. The girl was there. The brother would come. Only the wolf was missing. The rune seemed to pulse in her hand. Three in one, a knot of misery, denial, and slaughter. Odin was very near. It was time to summon her protector, the dead god's enemy. It would not be easy. The wolf had grown, she could sense, and was close to his full power. A creature that could stand in front of the master of magic and snap off his head would not respond to a witch's call. Something more was required to compel his attendance. The witch, whose mind was so linked to the caves that she could feel every movement within them, knew the girl had entered the Hoard cave. She would go to her. She touched her tongue to the rune again. This time, it tasted of blood. Chapter 50. Alone. What if there is no air? What if this leads nowhere? Adisla tugged at the rope with increasing desperation, able to see nothing at all. The passage from the bottom of the pool was long, dark, and entirely underwater, and she had gone too far down to turn back. She pulled and pulled, hand over hand, fighting down panic. The ceiling of the tunnel was smooth rock, but she kept hitting her head, which forced her to bend her neck down so her shoulders took the impact instead. She struggled against the urge to breathe in or give up, to hammer at the ceiling and waste energy. Then, abruptly, the passage rose. Air hit her face and she swallowed it down. She opened her eyes to blackness. She could see nothing at all, but crawled out onto the rough and potholed floor of a cave. She pulled herself up to sitting and felt something between her fingers, cold like autumn grass. Hello? The dead air of the cave seemed to cling to her skin. Dead air. That was the smell. Something was rotting. Adisla composed herself and reached for the pouch at her side for the flint, steel and tinder Feleg had taken from the Noaidi. The tinder was useless. She could feel it was soaked. But the flint and steel would work. She took them out, struck them together, and the corpses were upon her, rotten faces looming from the dark. In the awful instant of the flint's flash, she saw